for joining us on Holy Family Radio for Faith and Reason, where we connect culture and ideas to the daily lives of Catholics. I'm Dr. John Pinero, Associate Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Today I'm talking with Elizabeth Kelly, and we're going to be talking about male-female complementarity and really Catholic teaching on gender, on the two sexes, and exploring questions that I think only the Catholic Church seems to have the answers to. Questions in the modern world such as, are the differences between the sexes socially constructed? Many claim they are. Are they natural? Some claim they are. Are they both? Perhaps there's the answer. For my money, I think the Catholic Church has a great gift to give to the modern world with the answers to these questions. There's a lot of confusion out there. And Professor Kelly, who teaches at the University of St. Thomas in their Catholic Studies program, is here to help us with some answers, the kind of answers she gives to her students in a course she teaches called Woman and Man Philosophical Issues. Elizabeth Kelly earned her master's degree in Catholic Studies from the University of St. Thomas in 2009. Prior to that, her education also included creative writing from the University of Alaska at Anchorage and a bachelor's degree in English from the University of Kansas. She's currently the managing editor of Logos, a journal of Catholic thought and culture from the Center for Catholic Studies at the University of St. Thomas, where I believe we also have a number of our Grand Rapids seminarians in residence. Welcome to the program, Elizabeth.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I really looked forward to having you on the program. I heard you speak here in Grand Rapids several years ago for the Franciscan Sisters of the Eucharist. I'm a big supporter of theirs, and they're fans of the Catholic Studies program I direct, and there's a lot of good things going on in the church in Grand Rapids.
Yes, they're just a beautiful group of sisters. I was so blessed to meet them, spend some time with them.
Well, I'd like to start us off with something Pope Francis said a while ago. And now, as we both know, and as our listeners know, Pope Francis likes to say things, and he likes to not stick to scripts in the way that past popes have had. And this is something many people love about him, and it's something that some have written, at least in blogs on the internet, that caused them a bit of confusion, maybe unintentional. Who knows? But one thing he said struck me that has to do with our topic of male-female complementarity. And that is, he said, and I'm paraphrasing, that the church needs a theology of women. And as an admirer of Blessed Pope John Paul II's theology of the body and his letter to women, which I'm sure you probably assign in your class,
sure.
I guess when I heard that, I thought, well, I thought we already had one. And so I was wondering what you think he means, or is there something that deeper we're in need of, or areas to explore? How would what would you say he means by that? Not,
yes.
You know, I'm kind of asking to read his mind, but I don't mean it
right,
in that sense.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
what do you think
I'm
he means?
I'm hardly a papal scholar, but you know, I sort of chuckled at that too. In my class, sometimes I'll ask my students, you know, we have a women's studies degree. How come we don't have a men's studies degree? And it's kind of the same question here. Just I think that some of the intention behind a comment like that is recognizing a general sense of woundedness maybe among the women faithful for feeling discarded, disrespected, or not understanding fully the application of their own feminine genius, to borrow John Paul's phrase. I don't think he probably meant it in a literal sense that the church doesn't understand women. I think he wants to say, we want to help you understand, or we want to bring women into a greater understanding of themselves through church teaching. We want you to see that, in fact, we do cherish women. We do value their complementary gifts, and it's not an issue of power. Women, you know, look at Mother Teresa. That woman had nothing, owned nothing, you know, was nothing in many respects, just a little mite of a person. She's the most powerful person on earth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I go into sub-Saharan Africa and just say the words Mother Teresa, everybody's going to know who you're talking about. And that's power. That's power. And the reason that she, it sort of it is an embodiment of the feminine genius. You know, she took her gifts out into the world and she gave away her feminine gifts. She gave away her faithfulness, her faithful heart. And that's what gave her power. Not a degree that she had, not a hierarchical position that she may be held in the church. And so I think some he's trying to address a broader audience that doesn't understand the power and authority of the church and what the distinctions are between power and authority. You know, women have great power of influence. Look at Catherine of Siena, or, you know, she was another person, owned nothing, was nothing, had no education, and yet she had a tremendous powerful influence because she submitted her gifts entirely to the Holy Spirit and allowed herself to be used where she was. And I think sometimes, even among faithful Catholic women, they think, well, we don't have women cardinals, we don't have women priests, we don't have... that somehow that means that women are denigrated or less valued, and that's just simply not the case. So I think his call for a theology of women is a way of saying, let's bring about a greater understanding of how we appreciate women.
So we're looking for a way to appreciate women then, but not with the eyes of the world or with
right.
Some kind of Marxist power conflict interpretation,
right.
That everything's
right.
A power relationship of some kind.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I think that's probably what he's after. And, you know, students take my class. It's really a very hopeful thing. I wish everyone could sit in my class for a few hours because these young people, they come into this class because they're looking for a reasonable vocabulary to address a wildly sexually broken culture. They want to be able to offer a healing balm in a reasonable way to a culture that's wildly sexually confused and broken. And that's very moving to see. And I think that what Pope Francis, that big-hearted creature that he is sensing is just that sexual brokenness. And part of it is you can parse out this section on women's particular ways that they have been broken, but men are broken too, you know, and they have been wounded too by this culture. You know, one of the fastest growing populations of people receiving plastic surgery purely for aesthetic sake. I'm not talking about reconstruction after, you know, losing a hand in an accident or something like
sure.
that. Just purely aesthetics is older men.
Is that right? I had always heard that more, I don't know how true this is. This is one of those statements that I would tell my students, really, do you have some evidence for that? But I had always heard that more men dye their hair than women, statements like that. I don't know what this means or if it's true, or mm-hmm. maybe we'd even talk about what that's rooted in.
Sure.
But is that part of a, I guess it's a misunderstanding of beauty, but is that rooted in maybe a culture of the worship of youth and beauty then?
Sure.
Yeah.
I think that's definitely part of it. And, you know, I'm becoming an older woman. And man, I feel it. You know,
uh-huh.
I'm not attractive in the way I might have been when I was younger. You know, I'm not fit in the way I might have been when I was younger. You know, my body is entering into a different place, and boy, do I feel the pressure and the disregard of the world around me for that. And it's really palpable, and it's very interesting, and I'm not, I don't take it in because I know it's false, but, and I have such a strong, faith that, and the sacraments kind of guard you from that sort of lie, but boy, is it powerful. Boy, is that pressure. It's just, It sneaks its way into your brain when you don't even know it's coming. It sneaks its way into your heart when you're not even looking. And I think we have to really guard against what we let into our eyes and ears, and be very perceptive and prudent in judging what we're hearing and what we're seeing about where our true value is. And it's easy to say that, and it makes sense. And everybody out there is shaking their head going, oh, yeah, 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 yeah. But, you know, give up your television and the radio for Lent and see how your perceptions change with respect to particularly superficial areas, like what you look like, what you should own, how you should, you know, what kind of car you should drive. Give it up for a long period of time. It's like removing this mold or fungus from your house that you can't even see. You don't even know it's there. The kinds of messages that come in and just bombard us. It just takes so much less energy to fight against them if they're not there in your house to begin with. Of course, I'm on a radio broadcast.
They were waving from the control room. They said, well, maybe not Holy Family Radio.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You notice I didn't say Holy Family Radio. I said TV or Internet or, you know, whatever
sure.
It is.
I can recall my wife is a convert of many years, and I reverted after we were married to the faith. I was raised in the Catholic faith. And one of the first things we started doing, which seemed radical to our friends, was just fasting from television during Lent. And what would grow out of that is a recognition of how little TV I needed in the first place by the time the Lenten season would end.
Yeah.
But the other thing was, it wasn't just the false messages from the culture of death where the true and the good and the beautiful are inverted upside down and inside out. And, you know, youth becomes a synonym for beauty, and we all have to be, young. Somehow the old aren't beautiful, those kinds of things. It was also a lack of news, and it wasn't so much being out of the loop or not knowing what was going on in the world, but being bombarded by what a few folks somewhere thought was news and thought I needed to know. The things they thought were the most important things in life. Those were things I found I could really live without quite easily. And that was pre-internet. And now with the internet, we can all choose our news sources much more easily than we used to, for sure.
Yeah, my sister was a news producer, and she actually left the business because she said what actually makes it to the news is so far removed from the truth, she literally couldn't stomach it anymore. She couldn't tolerate it. And so, you know, I think you're right. It's not just that. And if you read my book, you know, I got rid of my television all those years ago. And you know, 2 weeks after having it out of my house, my prayer life, my writing life, all of these things just kind of took on this whole new level and were just blossoming at a whole new level. I had no idea how much energy that was sucking away from my spirit by just even having it in the house. And I was a single person, and I confess I was watching it far too much.
Sure.
I just would, you know, kind of have it on in the background a lot of times. And
right.
So if it's not an excess issue for you, that's completely different. But, yeah, it was just like a fresh breeze went through my prayer life, getting rid of that thing.
Well, one of the messages I think that news channels seem to take for granted, and you hear this in stories about the Catholic Church generally, and I don't just mean the kinds of stories that would run afoul of the Catholic League, but just general news stories, and that is that women are unhappy in the Catholic Church, that especially young married couples, but most married couples who are Catholic, don't follow Catholic teaching on contraception, and just a number of criticisms that there's just some old guard things that for some reason the church is hanging on to. It discriminates against women, but women still remain in the church for one reason or another. You know, how do we respond to criticisms like that? We have access to a vast intellectual tradition, of course, as Catholics. And you seem to touch on that as we were talking a few moments ago. You know, maybe there's other things, too. You know, maybe it's just it's biology, it's science, whatever it happens to be. But how do we respond to those kind of criticisms, something that's so accepted?
Mm-hmm.
that it's not even part of the story, that it may or may not be. It's accepted. It's the basis. It's the foundation for many news stories about women and the Catholic Church.
Yeah. One of my former students, Jessica Zitlow, is now the communications director for the Minnesota Catholic Conference. And she came and spoke to my class the other day, and we were talking about sort of the willed ignorance, people looking facts in the face and just flat out denying them. And that's kind of a disturbing new trend, just a complete disconnect between logic and reason and wanting to believe what you want to believe. At the same time, I said, you know, I asked her, you know, how in the face of that do you just continue to go back? And she says, you know, it's a combination of data, but also speaking from personal experience. So we can give them stats, you know. Families that practice natural family planning tend to be happier, stay together longer, you know, have a more satisfying sex life. You know, we can bombard them with facts, but also try to get to know them as people, because the conversion experience is not solely a collection of facts. It's falling in love with the truth. And the truth is a person, is the truth of Christ. And so we have to combine mind and heart in such a way that, and it's irresistible. You know, the truth doesn't need a marketing campaign. It doesn't need a business plan. The truth is attractive because it is truth. So one way, I think, is just to live as best you can in as broken a body as you might be, broken a person as you might be, a life of truth, a life that seeks the truth and to conform itself to the truth. And that is attractive. And it can be very effective in ways that we don't even know are happening. I'll give you an example. When I was at Harvard, I remember they asked me to do some work that was going to support the Harvard Stem Cell Institute. And, of course, that included embryonic stem cell research and all this sort of thing. So I found myself at an impasse. I went to, you know, Father George and the church in Harvard Square, and I said, I don't think I can do this, can I? And he's like, no, I don't think so. So we call up the National Catholic Bioethics people. Oh, thank you, Lord, for those articulate, wonderful people. They're practically laughing on the other end of the phone, just saying, you know, of course you can't do this, and these are the reasons why. And, you know, even being a fairly well-educated Catholic, I didn't have those sort of short talking points that I could go into my boss and say, you know, whatever. So eventually I had to say I had a religious objection, and, you know, they were threatening to fire me, and I said, you know, no, you can't do that according to the law, and there was this back and forth sort of thing. And some weeks after this happened, we had a big meeting. You know, there were 500 employees there, and they flashed this thing up on the big screen saying, if you have any kind of objection to working for the Stem Cell Research Institute, or, you know, these different things that would involve this kind of research, the different institutes and organizations, you know, you do not have to work on them. And then they just pulled it right down. And I remember kind of sitting there, the pariah. People knew what was going on with me, and I could see in their eyes, you know, their view of me just falling through the floor, because I believe life began at conception. Mm-hmm. You know, and no one would sit next to me, you know, in this group of 500 people. It was kind of funny. You know, I mean, it was really hard at the time, but now I look back at it and I just sort of chuckle. But some days later, a number of people sort of sneaked into my office and sat down and said, I'm so glad you did what you did, because I didn't want to work on that either, and I didn't know that I didn't have to. So, you know, again, that seems like such a small thing, but I think one of the ways that we have influence, that we have a way of drawing people to the truth in the world, is just by putting our money where our mouth is, you know.
So everything we do is evangelization then.
Yeah.
If you're teaching about the Catholic teaching on sexuality, in some way or another, if we're talking about truth, we're always evangelizing, or if we're behaving as if our life is in accord with the truth, like your witness there.
Sure. You and I are in a privileged position, because we are teaching young people that are coming in, and they want it. They want to know it. They want the truth. I have students who never miss a class, always prepared. You know, they're doing Catholic studies as a double major just to inform themselves, inform their own hearts and persons. You know, Harvard was a different story. You know, that's kind of like being on the front lines in some respects. Now, there's some wonderful Catholic organizations out there, but in the era in which I was there, it was slightly different, and my experience there was somewhat different. But again, I think we all have to take our turn really stating, not in any kind of aggressive way or attacking sort of way, but just stating with logic and with love the truths that we profess every time we go to Mass. And eventually, you don't know, I guess what I mean to say is you don't know how many people that may influence. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow. But eventually, if you hear the truth expressed enough, if you see it lived and lived well, it's going to be so attractive that you can't help but be tackled by that reality.
Exactly. And it's not going to happen on your timing.
Right.
But in God's timing. And I think teaching in general is about seed planting in lots of ways, which is why I find assessment and metrics so objectionable on several levels, because I teach at a liberal arts college at Aquinas, and of course you can't really measure how much somebody 10 years from now appreciates the Sistine Chapel when they're hearkening back to their humanities class.
Right.
Or when they're rereading Virgil's Aeneid when they're 35 years old, and you know, it means something different than it did when they were suffering through my class, doing their penance and working their way through the Aeneid.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's really true.
Well, let's get to the church teaching then. I think I like this program, Faith and Reason, on Holy Family Radio. I like this program to be all about what you've been describing, that is turning to the Catholic intellectual tradition to shape our daily lives, our relationships, and knowing that we have this reservoir there. Even those of us like you and me who are professors, we have to access that too. I don't know everything there is to know about the Catholic theology, believe it or not, right? And I'm the director of Catholic studies, and I'm an historian. But it's great to have people we can turn to. And your syllabus is just chock full of them, of course. There's our friends in print, and then there's people, of course, that are still with us and we can talk to on the phone and that you probably work with. So why don't, if we could just start with this question, if you could lay out a basis for what the church means by complementarity. What kind of complementarity is it? This is really seems to be the basis of the
sure.
church's teaching.
You know, I think that just one caveat before launching into it is that this notion of complementarity is fairly new territory. We're still discovering the vocabulary to explain church teaching. We're still delving into it, and this is why it's so delightful, but why it's also so tough.
Okay.
You know, there are some things that are a little resolved, you know, within Catholic dogma and doctrine, and this is one where there's a certain kind of resolution, but we don't have all the vocabulary fully. So God bless people like Prudence Allen and Blanca de Cortazar.
Yes.
Hannah Girl Falkowitz and all these people who are working on this particular issue to gather up the vocabulary. Where we are, I would say, is that the church is forming its vocabulary around integral sex complementarity. That is to say, there is one form of complementarity between men and women with two aspects, body and spirit. The opposition wants to argue that there are many forms of complementarity. There's personal complementarity. There's, you know, holistic complementarity. There are many different kinds of, there's orientation complementarity. But what that does is it bifurcates the human person. It separates us, separates a body and spirit. And that's just sort of classic dualism. This is one of the charges against some of the opposing voices that want to argue for same-sex marriage or whatever it might be. And it's very important to remember just the most basic fact is that the church does not reject the body. The church exalts the body because we believe in the resurrection of the body.
Yes, of course.
So we don't get to toss the body out of the calculus. The body's going to remain not more important than the soul, but it has to be taken into account.
Isn't it amazing how that old Gnostic idea condemned in the early years of the church about material and the body being a bad thing, it remains. It's still with us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It doesn't go away.
And it's funny because, you know, some of the opposition to church teaching claims that we make the body too important. We make biology too important. We make, you know, physical complementarity too important. And it's again, just this kind of radical dismissal of natural law, a radical dismissal of reality. You know, there are parts to our bodies, and they are meant to do specific things, and they're meant to fit in certain ways. And, you know, again, we don't exalt that because we think the body's more important or anything. It's because we recognize that God has designed the human person as body and spirit, and a perfect integration of those two things. So we can't just drop the body from the calculus. It has to remain. If it does, then things like orientation complementarity or personal complementarity, this act has meaning for me because it has personal meaning for me, therefore it's okay, all of that falls apart. You know, you just can't base things on personal meaning. You know, people who abuse children, it has personal meaning for them. It's not properly ordered personal meaning, but it has meaning,
sure.
You know. So, again, we just can't throw the body away.
So this integral sex complementarity, it sounds to me like this would be common sense for most people, and that we would almost, as humans, have to be deprogrammed in some way by our culture not to think that the obvious is true about male-female complementarity.
Sure. And there are plenty who argue that, you know, heterosexuality, you know, we've been sort of brainwashed to think that this is the origin of mankind, and that Adam was really androgynous and, you know, evolution and all this sort of thing.
Wow, I've never heard that one before.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's out there.
You encounter these more than I do, for sure. I'm sure. Yeah.
But, you know, the sense of the essential property, woman and man as prime analogates being rejected as the foundation for society, it's, again, just an example of a certain kind of willed ignorance. Every person on the planet has come into being as the result of a union between a woman and a man, whether or not that was in a petri dish or not, or, you know, however they do it, or it happened naturally, that is a radical fact. And so the church doesn't start from non-reality, she starts from reality.
Sure.
You know, this is really significant. And not only do we start from a woman and man, but what woman and man create in their fusion, in their union, is something of infinite eternal value. We don't give birth to a squirrel or an Oreo cookie. You know, we're giving birth to a soul is created, something that will remain into eternity. We can't just drive over that like a speed bump.
I think it was Aristotle who would say like begets like, and he was in some ways the father of common sense in some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
What comes from an acorn? Well, a tree. Well, that's as far as we know, it's the only place a tree comes from.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And this reminds me of the abortion controversy and talking about what is it exactly that's in the womb. Mm. And people will often say, those who are pro-abortion, that, well, it's either up to me to decide, or it's not a human yet, and don't put your religion's ideas, on to biology. But it's kind of the other way around. And the biology is obvious and there for anyone to see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you raise an interesting point, you know, especially when people come to the church and criticize it for not protecting women or for not celebrating women. In fact, I agree with your opening comments. I think the church is the only entity out there, well, not the only, but the major entity out there protecting women. The earliest feminists would be appalled by the notion of abortion. Their whole idea was to protect women in such a way that they could protect their families and their children, that they would be cared for economically and other ways, that their families would thrive. They'd be appalled by the ways that feminism has taken on new bents. Of course, there's so many different strains of it, so I'm making a very great...
Right. I mean, there are so many strains of feminism now, but of course, part of that early opposition to abortion is to keep women from being turned into... entertainment objects for men with no consequences on the other end. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, and, you know, this is another one of the ways that you just see Blessed John Paul's just absolute dazzling pastoral charism. When he wrote Mulieris Dignitatum, On the Dignity and Vocation of Woman, he opens it up saying, you know, this is a meditation on essentially, you know, why women are so important to salvation history, why the church protects her in the way that she does and values her in the way that she does. And I think that people want the church to come down with some sort of hard, fast dogma or doctrine about it, but he recognized that when you're wounded, you don't want someone to come and explain to you your wounds. You want healing. You want relief from the wound. Relief that comes in a kind of meditation, you know, not some dogma or doctrine. So again, I think if I were a woman out in the world and I were looking for some place to find my flourishing, the church really stands as a beacon, as an answer to that exact scenario.
And that's why the work of people such as yourself and pastors is so important, and it's why we don't want to confuse, let's say, theologians with pastors. They have different approaches, mm-hmm. and a theologian's going to lay out the arguments and the doctrine, but doctrine tends not to be warm and fuzzy and cozy, right? Just kind of lays it out, and it can sound dry and cold. But it's us applying. You know, we want to apply that when we're ministering to people.
And that's not to say that doctrine isn't important. It absolutely is.
Of course.
And thank God for Ratzinger and just the crystal clarity that he brings to so many topics. I mean, his books are just dazzling and wonderful. You can read them again and again and again.
But for these hurting people you're talking about, don't we, I mean, do you give them a book by Pope Benedict, or do you, having ingested all that yourself, witness to them in whatever way you think is necessary to heal them and bring them around to the truth? That, you know, you've got the connection to the dogma, to the intellectual tradition.
Right. If someone's house is burning down around them, you don't send them an email saying your house is burning down around you. You run into the burning house and you pull them out.
Right.
You know, so in some respects, I think on this question of sexual identity, the house is burning down, people, you know. Mm-hmm. And we're in a fortunate situation. We're coming in that young people want their minds formed so that they can minister with great integrity and depth. But you're absolutely right to say that there are two functions integrated, both necessary. And thank God we have them in the church.
Well, let's move to a couple hot button topics then. The ones that maybe many of our listeners have decided their minds on, and they think with the church on this, but maybe some of our listeners do not. And that would be maybe the most obvious question that some have about women in the Catholic Church, and that would be why we don't have priestesses. Why only priests?
Yeah, it's interesting. This question just never goes away. No matter how much we might think it's resolved, it's really important that people educate themselves in this particular question. I was at the Woman and Man Congress in Rome in 2008, And a debate broke out about this, and one woman was saying, we need to be talking about ordaining women, and others were saying, this has been put to rest, we need to understand why we reserve the ministry for men. And this little bishop from Canada, who had to be about 182 years old, he shuffled up to the microphone, and he said, listen, I've been teaching my entire life, and every time I teach a class around this topic, students have questions. Why don't we ordain women? We have to be responsible to answering this question. And the good news is that there are great resources for people who are wondering about this. I think it's important, if the question comes up, to understand, well, first of all, why somebody's arguing it. Some people are simply saying, well, we need more priests, and if we ordained women, that would solve the priest shortage. Or it's men and women are created in God's image, therefore, you know, any male-female hierarchy has to be eradicated. Or, you know, women are as good and as highly functioning in these roles, preaching and teaching and counseling. You know, they would be great priests. And, or, you know, Scripture doesn't explicitly exclude them. Women played incredibly important ministerial roles in the early church, and they must have required ordination. So you can, it's important, first of all, to understand what they're arguing and why. One of the biggest reasons that people argue for women's ordination is they say that the real source of this tradition, ordaining men only, is based on the patriarchalism of Christ's day. Both in Jewish tradition and in paganism of the time, this errant notion that women were inferior. And, you know, of course, the way we would respond to that is to say, well, Christ was wildly countercultural in many respects, including, and maybe most importantly, his attitudes toward women. When Christ enters human history, we have to remember, for example, this is just one example, that Roman laws of purification of women would have been very much in play. So the woman who's with the hemorrhage, who reaches out to touch his hem and says, if I can just touch the hem of his garment, I will be healed. That would have been a very serious offense. Very serious offense. But what does Christ do? He turns to her and says, you know, who touched me? But there's an acknowledgement of the touch, but there's no offense. There's no offense. That was so wildly countercultural, we can hardly even begin to imagine it because, you know, we're in the world of unisex bathrooms. But, you know, we have to place in context some of his response to the culture at the time. Women sat at his feet and were taught. Women accompanied him on his ministry. All of these things were wildly countercultural. If he took those steps to counter the culture, why didn't he take that last step? Was it just a matter of like, oh, well, I forgot to do that part? Well, no, of course not. And furthermore, the women who were with Christ at the time, great converts, wonderful holy women. It's not like he didn't have holy women to choose from. He had dazzling examples of holy women to choose from, and he still didn't do it. Now, those are some of the historical reasons behind it. When you get into complementarity and the notion of in persona Christi and that kind of thing, it gets a lot more sophisticated, and I don't know how much time we have to go into some of the intricacy there, but
I mean, that aspect is especially some Protestant Christians might ask, well, if the New Testament says that in Christ there's neither male nor female, Greek nor Jew, et cetera, then why not? Why couldn't, isn't a woman as Christ-like as a man?
Yeah, why is maleness important? Is being male
the actual bodily, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And again, we go back to what we were speaking of before. The body can never be thrown out of the calculus. We don't get to separate body and spirit. Is that to say that there's not a way that women can minister in a way of equal importance, that women can serve the church? No, but it's going to be different. It's always going to be different. And this is a very difficult and nuanced kind of argument. But again, we go back to that point of we are hylomorphic creatures. Therefore, we have to acknowledge the body. I sometimes just start with a personal example. My brother was ordained to the priesthood some years ago. And of course, we've had many conversations about this, and especially on the ontological aspect, the beingness. Is there some way that something settles on his male soul, this indelible mark, that can't settle on a woman's soul? You know, this is really the question. You know, being Christomorphic is not a sex distinctive gift. So what is it that's going on? And I think one thing to remember as we enter into conversations about this is not that there aren't things to know, but as Catholics, we believe in all things visible and invisible. There are going to be, and that's part of the delight of it, the delight of the walk of faith, the life of faith. And there are going to be things that we may never have adequate vocabulary to describe because we're talking about a transcendent reality. And this is one of them. And, you know, he said, as I'm getting up from being, you know, face to the marble, you know, nose to the marble, as they say, he said, there is something different that happens. He said, I feel it. He said, I can't articulate it, but it's something different. Because of the complementary ways in which men and women are ways of being a body, we say that women tend to be more the receptive and men tend to be more the agent to patient, if we're going to talk in philosophical terms, that there is a way that women receive the work of the Spirit in a different sense. We don't have perfect vocabulary to express that, but we can look to Scripture and we can ask, why was Jesus's maleness important? Well, what were the ways that he spoke about himself? What were the ways that he spoke about his father? You notice he never talks about his mother in the same way that he does. The symbolism of father, of son, of male slave, of Messiah, of bridegroom, all of these symbols have to work together. You can't just pull out one or the other. It's the same thing again. The church is always looking for abundance and moreness and integration. And so all these things have to work together. And if one of them doesn't work, then we know we're on to something, if there is a moreness that can't be created. So he spoke in terms of the father-son symbol. So we have to try to understand why it is that he did that. Why is that significant? The father symbol tying us to the new Adam, all of these sorts of things. I think I'm probably getting too detailed.
Well, no, you make me think of the imagery of the church also as the bride of Christ.
Yeah.
One of the beautiful things that I thought was a long time coming in the English translation of the Roman Missal was bringing back in the feminine pronoun for the church. And I was just very happy to see that the word it always kind of grated on me during the liturgy of the Eucharist, because I thought, well, if it's true that what Benedict says and what Christopher Dawson says, Dawson's a major influence on the Aquinas Catholic Studies program, that it's in the liturgy where culture has been transformed. It's in through the liturgy and long years of cultural transformation that the Rome of the gladiators turned into the Rome of Leo the Great. I mean, these things take a long time. And if it's in the liturgy, then I always thought with the old translation, we weren't really helping ourselves in terms of complementarity by removing that side of the equation.
No.
Or when we lower Marian devotion in the estimation of some in the church. I recall in my wife's RCIA class, I innocently asked. I was going through it to relearn the faith with her. and sponsoring her, which I guess is not really the best idea of a sponsor in retrospect, but it was it was good for both of us. And I remember innocently saying, when are you going to teach them the Hail Mary? No, we're not going to teach them that. I said, well, but, you know, it's the rosary is a major Catholic prayer, which wasn't a devotion of mine at the time. No, no, not anymore. I said, really? Because everywhere I look, including at John Paul, this is in the very early 90s, 91, 92, I said, it seems like the rosary is very popular. Mary still seems quite popular as far as I can tell. And that's, I...
Again, you know, John, JP2, if you've read Love and Responsibility, sort of that whole argument is that we find our spiritual maturity not just in faithfulness, but in fatherhood, in motherhood. We don't just stay the prodigal son or daughter. We are invited into the fullness of parenthood. And in the same way that being a priest expresses that kind of fatherhood, you know, being a sister expresses motherhood. They're complementary roles. They're not interchangeable. And thank God for that. We're not homogenous blobs. You know, but I do think that that's very important to, in this kind of conversation, also point out the roles that women do play, how their motherhood is manifest in service to the church.
And so Mary is the, what, she's the ultimate example of that? I mean, she's the best example of a disciple, certainly, but I've heard critics of the Catholic Church's understanding of Mary say something like this. So how would you respond to this? You kind of raise up Mary and she takes up all the oxygen in the room, and then you tell women they should just be mothers. Just is always the key word in their phrase to give you an idea of what they might think of motherhood. Uh-huh. But what about those who want to be employed? What about career women?
Speaking to one.
I know.
You know, I'm unmarried. I have no children. And yet I intrinsically believe that Edith Stein says it this way. Any woman can occupy any job in any profession. And in fact, she should. Because when a woman enters an environment, she humanizes it. She brings her complementary gifts of humanizing an environment. And that's a very powerful thing in a world that's becoming increasingly mechanized and technologized, that a woman's feminine genius helps to humanize an environment. Now, does that mean that you have to experience motherhood or fatherhood in a biological sense? Well, of course not. But the essence of that, the essence of motherhood is something that I'm very much interested in developing in my own person, a kind of receptivity.
And that's part of the feminine genius, whether one is a biological mother or not.
Sure.
Is that what you're saying? Sure.
You know, and John Paul II loved Edith Stein, and he would say the same thing. You know, we need women in the professions. It's it is a different era. 100 years ago, I couldn't have the life that I have. It just wouldn't have been possible, or it would have been very, very difficult. 200 years ago, it would have been, you know, almost impossible for me to live as a single person in my own home, have my own job, have my own whatever.
Right.
And, but you know, we can't assume that God's up in heaven going, oh my gosh, I didn't see that one coming. You know, in fact, one of the premises of a book that I'm working on called A Single Woman's Worth is that maybe there are more women being allowed to be single and moving into the workforce and moving into the world is because we have lost a human aspect, and we need to restore that humanity to the culture. And one of the ways to do that is through the professions. You don't go out and teach as a man would teach. You teach as a woman would teach, or you bank as a woman would bank, or you are a financial advisor as a woman financial advisor.
That type of new feminism is not trying to be trying to be a man, in other words.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Sure. When last January 2013, the Catholic Studies Speaker Series at Aquinas College hosted Sister Prudence Allen. And you mentioned her earlier. I've looked at the syllabus for your Woman and Man Philosophical Issues class at the University of St. Thomas, and you've assigned a lot of Sister Allen in there. And I have to tell you, one of the things she said that really struck me, and this was a packed house in the Wege Ballroom at Aquinas College, struck me as she said, we need to reclaim the word gender, that this isn't just a word that implies social construction, that this it's deeper than that, it's more than that. And I think I was one of the ones who had strenuously avoided use of the word gender ever in the classroom for fear that I would be implying just that, somehow the sexes were social constructions, and that's it, and not even a mix. Would you mind elaborating on what sure. Sister Allen means by talking about reclaiming a word like gender? Because as you know, you have a women's studies program, Aquinas has a women's studies program, and they often talk about it as gender studies,
right.
But there really aren't a lot of men's studies programs out there, right? But you hear that we do have a gender studies, some classes or a club like that at Aquinas, and I wonder about that. I wonder what they're studying exactly.
Well, sure. It's it's a tricky word. It's like feminism. What do you mean?
Yeah.
In what discipline are you using it? Theological, philosophical, anthropological? And I think she's very wise to remind us that if we are going to use that word, we need to know exactly what we mean when we say it and be explicit to say, when I use the word gender, this is what I mean, not just a social construction. A lot of the gender studies automatically assume more than two genders. They reject dimorphism. They want to have, at least five genders recognized. So are you talking about a biological reality? Are you talking about a social construction? I think she's right to caution people, and we talk about that a lot in my class when they're reading newspaper articles or hearing something out in the broader world and people are throwing these terms around. It's really important to understand how those people mean to use them and what it means.
So if you hear a phrase, gender equality, it might not simply refer to equality of under the law, let's say, between men and women. It may be they may be meaning much more by that.
Yeah, I think we're in Germany. They're already giving you at least a third, if not a fourth and fifth option to claim with respect to gender. So, they are legally rejecting a dimorphic reality. And
wow. If there was a space on a forum where I could mark that I'm weary of nonsense.
Right.
That would be great. If we could add that one, I'd be all for that.
Mm-hmm. On the drop down menu of the plain manifest, male, female, really tired of all this nonsense. Yeah. That would be good. Yeah, I'm with you on that one. So I don't know that I agree with her that we need to reclaim it. In other words, I think there's so much baggage attached to it. I think we may need to find a completely different way to speak of it. I think what we really need to reclaim.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr.
Masculine
John Panero, on Holy Family Radio.
Man and woman.
If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Panero is Associate Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith
we
and Reason
hosted,
is brought to you by Holy Family Radio.
A
I'm your program producer, Michael Ferenzo. Join us next time as we connect the richness of the Catholic
and
intellectual
and a few
tradition
other faith
to daily life.
Talking
thanks for
about
listening.
What does it mean and why we don't do it, or some said why they think it's okay. And it was kind of exploring the matter, right? And the one thing I was adamant about before this panel could even be held on our campus, we have a speakers and programming committee at Aquinas to vet things for to make sure they're not advocating something contrary to Catholic moral teaching, is that when the idea first was floated, people kept calling it same-sex marriage. And I said, wait a minute, we can't use the term marriage because it implies that it is a marriage, but it's just some kind of different kind of marriage.
Exactly.
But once we do that, we've already given away the farm. You know,
right.
once we're using those terms, it's hard to turn back from that. So I think you're right about a new searching for this new vocabulary you're talking about. The early church had access to the Greek philosophical vocabulary, and that was a great help when they were talking about the Trinity and the relationship among the persons of the Trinity. And I don't know what we have to turn to other than sometimes I would be afraid we would end up with very clunky philosophical terms mm-hmm. that the average person would say, I don't know what that means. You've got four hyphens and four words
right.
put together, and
right.
I can't really use that in a 100-word right. Newspaper column.
Yeah, well, and I think it's important to when you are in these discussions, because they are often functioning in kind of an interdisciplinary realm. In other words, we don't just give a theological response. The underpinning of our theological response is a philosophical response. You know, so there is kind of an interdisciplinary approach to, well, especially Catholic studies, but to this kind of question. It's not just a matter of biology. It's not just a matter of sociology. Aquinas would be appalled by that there are even sociology departments in the sense that he would say, well, we need to have philosophy departments, you know, and then everything sort of grows from that. But it's just important, if you're going to use a term, to know exactly what you mean by it and be explicit to say, before you use it, when I say gender, this is what I mean, and then stick to that.
Thinking clearly, that's what we need from our philosophy classes.
Definition. You know, it's all in the terms.
Well, you've been listening to Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio. This is Dr. John Pinero. I've been talking with Professor Elizabeth Kelly of the University of St. Thomas for about the last hour about male and female complementarity. There were a number of things I thought we'd get to or hoped we'd get to, but we had a good conversation on this issue. Maybe we'll have you back then to talk about
sure.
some of your other works.
Sure, anytime.
Now, is there anything you would like to close with, just to give you the last minute here? You said you were working on a new book. Do you know when that will be released?
No, I'm very much in the early stages of actually two new books to come out. But I guess if I had to leave a closing thought, it would just be to say that we should be hopeful about these topics. You know, we have truth on our side, and truth is attractive, and we don't need to worry unnecessarily about this weird stage of the world. I think that we just need to work to honor the truth, and that's all that's important, really.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Professor Elizabeth Kelly. This is John Pinero of Faith and Reason on Holy Family Radio. Hope you have a good day.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinero is Associate Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.
Lori's Voice will be hosting a walkathon fundraiser on Saturday, June 14th at Berlin Raceway in Marne. You are invited to walk with Janice Allen from Fox 17, Jordan Carson from Wood TV, and Mrs. Michigan, Rebecca Jo Skolten. Lori's Voice is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to support and enrich the lives of children with muscular, neurological, and other degenerative diseases. For registration and additional information, please go to www.lorisvoice.org.